interesting video. If you go over there, you click on it, you could see pretty much what I just told you. But it's very well done. Good, good picture. They have just one announcer, Arian Corner. She's done all the broadcasts for Blue Origin. And I would check it out. It's worth it. Let me drop it. Okay. There's another topic I wanted to discuss, and that has to do with one of the astronauts on board. I believe I mentioned this last week, but I'll do it again. Christina Koch is an astronaut that's on board the space station right now. There's six people on board, and she got the okay from NASA to stay on for almost a year. She'll be up there for 340 days. She was up there about a month and got this information that she's now going to be part of the long-term testing. You might remember a couple of years ago, Scott Kelly, he knew he was going to be going up for a year. He went up for almost a year and then came back. He was the guy that had the twin brother on Earth. He was running the exact same test on Earth as Scott was in space. And that testing has concluded, but now they want to do it again. So they're going to test out Christina Koch. She'll be the first woman involved with this long-duration test program. And then another fellow, Morgan, he'll be going up in July. And he already knows that he'll be staying for a year. Or almost a year. They go up for almost 340 days. Unless there's delays, and then they really will stay for a year. And sometimes that could happen. I was wondering, was this a shock, But then I saw an interview with, a live interview with Christina Koch from the space station. She's floating around in the Kaibo Japanese module, and she said she kind of like knew it was a possibility. They had discussed it, but they didn't know it when they launched for sure. So she's very happy about this. Now, as an astronaut, that's what you want. You want to be able to stay on the space station. That's what they love doing. Let me drop it for any comments or questions. Now, Dick mentioned CRS-17 mission. Now, that was the mission that just was launched by SpaceX from Launch Complex 40. And it's on the way, I think, probably today or so. It will be docking with the space station. They had quite a few delays. Weather was almost a problem. They did manage to take off. But not before, one other delay. They had a power problem on the drone ship 17 miles out in the ocean. Their booster is supposed to come back and land on a drone ship. This was actually Plan B. It was originally supposed to come back and land in Cape Canaveral, but they had a problem with their landing pad. Landing zone 1 is where the booster would normally come back. Of course, right now there's nothing but debris on that complex right now because SpaceX ran a test on the Dragon crew vehicle that just went up to the space station about a month ago and came back perfect, 100% up, 100% down. Everything went great. It was the actual crew vehicle. If you put somebody in there, they would have survived all the way up and all the way back. It wasn't a cargo vehicle, which means on board, they also had massive Super Draco engines. Super Draco engines are what they're going to use for, for a launch abort system. If there's an emergency, these things would light off, and it would give you about twice the amount of thrust than the original New Shepard, Alan Shepard rocket that he went up on the Redstone rocket, roughly around 125,000 pounds of thrust. So what happened was the same rocket that went up to the space station and came back, the Dragon crew vehicle, they attached it to a test van out at Launch Complex 1, or they call it Landing Zone 1. They attached it, and they were testing the thrusters. They tested the Draco thrusters, the normal thrusters that they use for maneuvering in space. There's 12 of them. That went fine. But then they lit off these 8 Super Draco engines. They have 8 of them surrounding, circumference of the vehicle. And, you know, they were about to test that about a half a second before the valves open up, and it's a hypergolic mixture. It means that it's going to mix with nitrogen tetroxide. It just blew up. I mean, completely disintegrated. So there was nobody there. Nobody got hurt. But there's debris and everything all over the landing zone area. So now NASA and SpaceX are both looking into what caused that problem. And they don't want to disturb anything. There's hydrazine fuel all over the place, which is carcinogenic. They have to, slowly clean everything up and then eventually figure out what went wrong. So therefore, this booster that went up the other day to the space station that's supposed to come back and land in landing zone 1 couldn't do that. So they positioned the drone ship that catches these things about 17 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean, which usually they go around 300 miles out, and sometimes all the way to 600 miles when they use the Falcon Heavy. That's the one with the 3 big boosters that they got bolted together that they flew to here not too long ago. But this one was only 17 miles out at sea. But sure enough, the ship itself had a power problem. If that had a power problem, they had to delay that rocket launch again until the next day. So they had about four delays. One earlier delay that they had was because of the space station. The space station itself had a power problem. They have these units. There's 4 of them on the space station that they're called main bus switching units. MBSUs, they call them. They completely fail. They don't know how to fix it. They do have spares up there, and they're going to use the robotic arm to switch it out. But before they did that, because it's an important power supply for the robotic arm, they need duality power for the robotic arm when a spacecraft goes up and docks with the space station. Because of those rules, they had delayed another day. But finally, make a long story short, they finally got off the ground and brought that pair of 5,500 pounds up to the space station. Normally, if you use another cargo vehicle, like the Cygnus vehicle that's being launched by Northrop Grumman, you can get 7,500 pounds, a couple thousand pounds more. But you have to realize that, you say, why is one, so much more than the other? SpaceX has to bring up heavy parachutes. They have to bring up a very heavy heat shield because they come back and land in the ocean. They bring supplies and equipment, experiments back from the space station where the Cygnus spacecraft just gets launched up from Virginia, from Wallops Island, Virginia, and goes to the space station with 7,500 pounds of stuff. But when that leaves, Cygnus does not come back and land in the ocean. It burns up, so they don't need the parachutes and they don't need the heat shield. The Antares rocket has also been juiced up over the last couple of years. Originally, they were running older engines, and now they have newer, more upgraded engines to power the Antares rocket. So they used to go up with about 4,500 pounds in the beginning, and now they're up to around 7,500. So they're doing good. And next time, I think they're going to be able to bring about 5% more weight up. They found another way of able to do that. Let me drop it. So between between Cygnus and between SpaceX Dragon cargo vehicle and the Japanese HTV, they bring up around 10,000 pounds. You want to go up, and Progress brings up around 6,000 pounds. Between that's plenty to supply the space station with all the needs that they need for, you know, clothes, food, science equipment, and also down mass. SpaceX is the only one that brings back any heavy equipment, science modules that have to be brought back. So that's the story on that. We'll keep an eye on that. That's their 17th flight up to the space station. Antares has launched 11 Cygnus vehicles up to the space station. Actually, that's not true. There was three that was launched by the Atlas V when the Antares was being rebuilt, going from the older engines to the newer engines. But there's a lot of ways to get up there, but the problem is we need to get people up there. Right now, the only way to do that is Russian Soyuz vehicle. And now it looks like that because of this explosion on the landing zone one, when they were testing the crew vehicle out that just went up to the space station, and they tried to test the Draco engine, and that blew up. That vehicle was designed to do another test. They wanted to be able to put that on top of a rocket and launch it as it was going up to space. When it gets up to maximum Q, that's the speed where the atmosphere and the push of the rocket are the most intense. They wanted to be able to launch the crew vehicle, the Crew Dragon vehicle, away from the Falcon 9 booster to duplicate saving a crew. So now that's been canceled because there's no more crew vehicle. There is one that was being built, and it's been under construction, that was going to be the actual vehicle to bring bring a crew up to the space station at the end of this year. Now they're going to use that one for the in-flight abort test, and I still haven't figured out that they're going to continue with that vehicle and use that for a crew vehicle, or if they are going to use another one that is being manufactured in Hawthorne, California, where these things are made. We'll see. Let me drop it. Any questions or comments for now? This is WS2N. There is another launch mid-May, again by SpaceX, and that will also be launched out of Launch Complex 40, the same one that the cargo vehicle went up on. It takes a couple of weeks to straighten out the pad after a launch. So they have another one ready to go. And this one has satellites on board. They call them Starlink satellites. And this is their, well, they've actually sent two up from Vandenberg Air Force Base a year or so ago, and just as a test. But the Starlink system is going to be, well, it's going to be a broadband system that people could buy. All you're going to need is a little antenna pointed up to space and pick up one of these satellites, and you're gonna be able to pay SpaceX to get on the internet and broadband, and that's their ultimate plan. And we're talking about these are maybe 10 satellites or so that they plan on launching out of thousands. I mean, the Starlink program, well, they cut back. It was originally going to be 7,500 satellites. Now they cut back to about 4,400 satellites. So this is going to go on for many years, SpaceX launching these things. We'll have to see how it works out. There's other companies involved as well doing this type of work. There's OneWeb. OneWeb wants to establish their own internet. Their own internet bridge system. Telsat, another company, they think they could do it with 120 satellites. I don't know how they're going to do that. And then even Blue Origin has plans on building the Kuiper satellites. There's going to be 3,000 of them. You had all these satellites up for all these different companies, and you got a minimum of 8,000 satellites that are expected to go up within the next, 4 or 5 years. Different companies will be able to launch it. There's countless small private companies that are planning on launching smaller payloads up to space that are going to get in on the action. But we'll see. I just can't imagine all these thousands of satellites going up. And it's like doubling the amount of active satellites that we have now. It's like almost 10,000. It's like adding another 8,000 or so more satellites. Let me drop it. But that's the plan. SpaceX has already been approved. Their satellites are going to be linked to one another by laser beams. They're going to be shooting lasers at each other for communications. And the downlink is going to be Ka and Ku band. So they supposedly have about 1 million customers already lined up. But I guess instead of paying Cablevision or what are the other ones that we got? Cox and Time Warner. I guess you're going to be paying, SpaceX or, Teltex. One of these companies that, OneWeb. Now, are they going to be competitive? Are we going to be able to pay, less for doing that? Or is it going to cost just amount? Probably the same amount of money. We'll have to see in the future. But the Ka band is going to start, I think it's around, it's somewhere between the 12 and 18 gigahertz. The Ku band. And then the Ka band, of course, is higher than that. I think 25 or 26 gig and above. And they plan on having low latency, too. So you won't have to worry about the delay as if it was up in the geosynchronous area. These things are only going to be like, maybe 300, 400 miles up. Originally, they wanted to be like 700 miles up, but they talked with I guess all the powers to be, and they decided to lower it. Even so, they're going to have every satellite's going to have an ion thruster on it. Talking about what Roy was talking about, more modern propulsion. Well, SpaceX has it on this. There's going to be ion propulsion. It doesn't get them off the ground, but once you're in space, you could maneuver around and change locations pretty easily. So they're going to have that. And one has a failure, they expect, maybe a couple of years before there is rarefied air up at that level. It's there, not much, but it's enough to slow the satellite down and eventually degrade the orbit and burn up in the atmosphere. And it's better than leaving them at 700 miles, where if something went wrong, they might be up there for 1,000 years. So that's the story on that. Let me drop it. Okay. Any questions on Starlink? Again, that's a NASA deal. He's got a factory that he's built that they're going to start mass producing these things, I guess, like cars. But, and Blue Origin, they plan on doing it. I think their factory's going to be in the state of Washington. Blue Origin has already built a gigantic building down in Expedition Park in Florida, maybe 10 or 15 miles away from the launch complex, where they're building their New Glenn. The New Glenn is a much bigger rocket, of course. That's going to come after New Shepard. New Shepard will be used for taking people into space on joyrides. New Shepard will have, more or less in the beginning anyway, a different purpose of putting up satellites and eventually people into orbit. That thing, the size of it is almost as big as the Saturn V rocket. It's a massive rocket. And that's going to be running on liquid methane and liquid oxygen. And the earliest launch date for New Glenn would be around 2021. couple of years from now. Okay, very good. By the way, Glenn is a Blue Origin company, and Blue Origin is owned by Jeff Bezos, you know, the richest guy in the world. It's really Amazon. And that's his, where he likes to spend his money. Every year he says he spends another $1 billion or so on Blue Origin. They're making headway little by little. Not as fast as SpaceX right now, but they're going in the right direction. Not many failures. Yeah, they're doing good. One of the an interesting communication experiment is an X-ray communication device. They call it a modulated X-ray source experiment. And what it's going to do is modulate X-rays. And they have, you know, an idea of in the future using this thing to communicate through a plasma situation. Plasma meaning, you know, when vehicles go at, for instance, hypersonic vehicles, say 5,000 miles an hour through an atmosphere, which eventually NASA plans on building these vehicles, they would have plasma surrounding it, and you'd like to be able to talk through it, through this plasma, and they would be able to do that with X-rays. X-rays would penetrate that plasma. But they're experimenting with that, and of course also on re-entry. You know, when you come down in any kind of capsule, you know, it was a space shuttle, but now capsules, back to capsules again, you have the ionized field around all these vehicles, and you always lose communications for sometimes a minute or so, and it's kind of nerve-wracking for mission control and nerve-wracking for the crew. So they've come up with this X-ray communication device that they're going to install on one end of the International Space Station. And at the other end of the space station, they have what they're going to be using as a receiver. It's something called the Neutron Star Interior Composition Explorer. And the acronym is NICER. This thing has been attached to the space station for a while, and its goal has been to look for X-ray sources in the in space. They have it pointing up, and you know, to try to figure out what's the deal with neutron stars. And you know, they would like to be able to find some information with that. But since this thing receives X-rays, they're going to take this other transmitter that SpaceX has just bought up, and they're going to put one at one end of the space station, the other one at the other, and they're going to see how good this thing could copy a modulated transmission. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that little experiment works. That's one of the gadgets that are in the trunk of the cargo vehicle. SpaceX sends the vehicle up, and what looks like what we used to call the service module on the back of it is what they call the trunk, and it's open. It's open to space. After it gets berthed or, you know, bolted to the International Space Station, they'll use a robotic arm. They reach in, they grab this transmitter, X-ray transmitter, and robotically they'll attach it to the truss of the space station. That's the deal with that. One other launch that took place just the other day, yesterday morning, the first night launch for this company. This is a Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is owned by this guy, Peter Beck, another billionaire. He comes out of New Zealand, so he built his own launch complex in New Zealand. Launches off the North Island, two big islands in New Zealand, and got the approval to build a launch complex there. And this is his sixth launch. He's done five before, and this one was also successful, and he launched a couple of satellites, actually, for DARPA, for the United States. So he's got one big heavy satellite and a couple of smaller ones, and apparently it made it to orbit successfully. He's doing good. He does not have a reusable vehicle. He builds the whole body of the booster out of carbon. It's like a 3D setup almost. So it's a real throwaway rocket. But he puts on the bottom 9 Rutherford engines. Each engine is powered by an electric motor. Electric motor turns the turbines instead of using the exhaust on a jet or a rocket engine. He uses an actual electric motor, so he's able to cut down the cost. Each motor is 50 horsepower. Each one powers these turbines over 1,000 RPM a second, and he's able to pump all the fuel in. He uses a regular kerosene fuel, RP-1, rocket petroleum 1. It's really kerosene and liquid oxygen, and he's pumped and poured it into these 9 engines. And off it goes, and when it gets to MECO, main engine cutoff, that separates. Second stage comes out, just like when you watch it live, they have cameras on it, and it's almost like watching a SpaceX launch. All of a sudden, you see that last engine on the second stage light up and push the payload to orbit. This is WS2S. So that was successful. Last week I ran out of time, but we had so many topics last week. But this week I have the time. InSight, which landed on the Mars a couple months ago, is still up and running, still sending pictures back. Not a rover; it's staying in one place. It's really a seismometer. That's the main idea of this mission. The seismometer is working fine because they detected their first Mars quake about a week or two ago. So that was successful. They have this extremely sensitive seismometer mounted in sitting on the planet itself. They had a robotic arm put it there. And even if there's any kind of movement in the surface, that even the width of an atom, this thing could detect it. And it did detect a Mars quake. So something went on in the Mars surface. Either a meteorite hit or something actually moved in the surface of Mars. So naturally, the scientists are happy about that. And they expect to get maybe a half a dozen of these Mars quakes maybe per year. There were other experiments that did not work out, and that was the one that they were going to drill or pound a mole into the surface. Unfortunately, that has not been resolved. They got about halfway out of it, had put it on the surface, everything was fine, and the thing was going to start pounding its way in, and right away they think it hit a rock, and it went out on a 45 degree angle and stopped, and that's the end of that. That was supposed to dig down 15 feet into the ground and pull behind it a temperature sensor, and they were going to take readings of different temperatures inside the planet. I think that's going to have to wait for a future flight. And that's pretty much it. That's all I have, Dick. If there's any questions or comments, this is WS2M for the SpaceNet Report. For the TechNet.
Let's see if we got anybody with any further questions. If not, we'll just quit a little bit early tonight. Good stuff. What's the total number of private organizations associated with the United States that are building launching vehicles, Paul? Seems like there's about 5 of them. Over to you, Paul, KQLAW.
Yeah, there's a couple I don't mention. There's Vector. That's another one they're building. They've launched suborbitally, but haven't done it. Not much after that, but I expect them to to get going not too long from now. They also want to launch out of Virginia Wallops Island. And then this guy I just talked about, Peter Beck, with Rocket Lab, with the electric motor, motors that push the fuel into the Rutherford engines. That's called the Electron Rocket, and that's run by Rocket Lab. So you got Vector, Rocket Lab, because he's officially out of the United States, even so he built his complex in New Zealand. He plans on putting one in Virginia as well. In fact, they broke ground on that. Maybe by the end of the year, we'll see a launch with the Electron Rocket from there. They have what I consider small ones, Vector and them. Let me drop it. And then, of course, you have SpaceX. You have Blue Origin. You have Northrop Grumman. Don't forget, they bought a company called Orbital ATK not too long ago, like, I don't know, less than a year ago. And they launched the Cygnus vehicle. Antares is the rocket that launches the Cygnus to the space station. So that would be six. And then, if you want to include the NASA ones, which is Boeing and Lockheed, they launched together on something called ULA, United Launch Alliance. So now you're up to eight companies, and I might have missed somebody. we can't forget the foreign countries like Virgin Galactic. I mean, they are going to be flying out of the United States, so they'll be flying suborbital, so that would be nine. Back to you, Dick.
Boy, once NASA stepped back and these commercial organizations could step forward, nine of them. Wow. Now, in the past, the pumps that pump the fuel and oxidizer into the chamber of a rocket engine are quite often turbo pumps. I think a turbo pump is really a small jet engine producing tremendous amounts of horsepower because you're moving a lot of fuel at a high pressure, so that takes a lot of energy to do it. To do that with an electric motor backed up by a battery and to get enough energy out of that electric motor, that sounds like a tough way to go. Has that electric motor rocket engine been fired very often successfully for any reasonable length of time, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
I have a
question. Yeah, many testing. They did a lot of testing for years, and then finally got the first launch a couple of years ago from New Zealand. So that has nine separate engines on the first stage, and then one on the second stage, and each motor, electric motor, pushes 50 horsepower. And that he's got actually lithium-ion batteries pushing those motors. He's able to, it's a closed circuit deal. He's able to get extra thrust out of each engine because of that system. You lose thrust when you're using, exhaust or pre-exhaust, they call them pre-burners. If you're using that, you're actually wasting thrust, but you need that to run the engines. But he's doing it with batteries and electric motors. He's the only one that's doing that.
Interesting. I heard somebody say they got a question. Who was that?
WHYY. I was listening earlier about you talking about sending men back to the moon. Has Grumman been involved in this very much? Because it seemed like they invented the way of getting there. Get people to the moon and off the moon, we're called the LEM, and it worked very successfully then. Why do we invent the wheel? Would they have to really reinvent things too much to make that happen again?
Well, what we called Grumman doesn't exist. Now it's Northrop Grumman, a different group of people in a different location. So let's see what Paul's got to say. What's Northrop Grumman doing with reference to hardware to get to and land on the moon? Paul, go ahead.
Blue Orange is involved with that. They're going to build something. Eventually, I think it's going to be called the New Armstrong. So He named the first one New Shepard for what he's got going now, suborbital. And then because Glenn was the first American that went orbital, he's got the new Glenn that will be launched in 2021. And then you have, I think, probably a lander or something that's involved with that. But he wants to supply NASA with materials. NASA puts things on the moon. They want to be the ones to supply it naturally because he's part of Amazon, and Amazon likes to supply things to everybody on Earth, and now they want to do the moon. So they actually have drawn up plans for that. Lockheed is pretty far along with actual lunar lander. They'll be able to land four people at a time. They're moving along. Northrop Grumman, right now, not involved with the landers themselves. They're involved with actually launching rockets now. They bought up this orbital ATK, so they're launching the Antares rocket from Virginia. But they have another one that's going to come online in a couple of years. Let me drop it. It's called the Omega A. Correction, it's called Omega with a big A at the end. But Omega is going to be their, it's a solid booster rocket. It's going to launch from Launch Complex 39D, which is one of the launch complexes that the shuttle used to use down in Florida. They've been rebuilding that whole complex for years for the STS, Space Launch System, the SLS. NASA's been rebuilding that. But since they're not going to have many flights going from that, they're going to share it with Northrop Grumman. Northrop Grumman is going to launch Omega out of that launch complex, which will be a big rocket. I mean, probably 6-7 million pounds of thrust, and that's going to be all solid booster system, segmented boosters. We're eventually going to be able to put crew on the top of that. They're going to make it man-rated. Of course, it's going to be all cargo in the beginning. Back to you, Dick.
Now, you mentioned a company that's building a lunar lander capable of landing four people on the moon. Run that by again. What company? How far along are they? Who is funding them on this one? Are they that convinced that we're really going back to the moon if they're willing to make a multi-million-dollar investment in developing a four-people lander for the moon? Over to you on that one, Paul, K2LIW.
I should find a picture of this. I have it somewhere, but there's a picture of Lockheed that has been developing this, and that was the latest one that came out, and it's, I don't know, it looks like it's twice as large as LEM, it's massive. And, it would have the capability of launching to the moon, four people on the moon. But to me, it's not much different than LEM. It's going to leave the lander behind, and that lander will be able to be used for other purposes. But the top part is going to take off with the crew, and then they'll be able to link up with the Gateway system. The Gateway is, actually, Lockheed is involved with that, too. I think they're involved with the propulsion unit on the Gateway. The lunar idea is, Roy mentioned it earlier today, you put a Gateway space station in orbit, everybody's involved with that. You're going to have Lockheed, Boeing, and then also Northrop Grumman with the Cygnus vehicle they launched with the... They launch cargo with. They want to make that where it's going to be part of the space station around the moon. So you have that set up, and then for now, I've seen the only manned version I've seen so far is Lockheed, but I know Blue Origin is also working on it, but I haven't seen any drawings from them or pictures.
Ordinarily, a company building a lander for the moon, I would say, gee, that's a blue sky project that's never going to go anywhere, but Lockheed, that's a big company with a lot of track record of building some exotic hardware in the past, okay? And lots of people are involved in these Gateway, which I think is another name for a continuous orbiter around the moon. What's your guess, Paul, as to what year we're going to see hardware near the moon, gateways around the moon, and so on, and getting ready to launch landers to the moon? What year are we talking about when this is likely to happen? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Well, if you listen to the administration or Bridenstine, you know, you think this is all going to happen before, you know, 2024. I'm going with Roy. I'm going to double. I'm adding 4 years to that. The earliest I'm going to go with is 2028. I got to go with that. Okay, so I'll stick with that. Let's see. I'm going to take a wild guess and say 10 years from now. Back to you, Dick.
And you and I can calculate what age we're going to be at that time. All three of us can. And what's the chances of us actually seeing that? Let's see if Joe's got any further questions along these lines. What a question. To be 12YY, K2IW. You're staying up kind of late tonight, Joe.
How radio will travel. Sure, I got a question. I've wondered about this for quite a while. What do they do on all these flights, well, especially against the space station and so forth? What do they do with human waste? They don't just dump that outside. Is that, like, collected and then report back to Earth on equipment visits? How is that done?
I'm going to guess Paul's going to tell us that the urine is reprocessed back into, separated back into fluid. And the solid material, I'll bet you that's put into some of these craft that enter the atmosphere and burn up. Is that true, Paul? These guys up on the space station are continuously making a whole lot of solid waste. It's got to go somewhere, Paul. And I don't think there's any way of reprocessing it yet. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's why you need the ones that burn up over the Pacific, South Pacific. Progress burns up. The Cygnus vehicle burns up. And also the Japanese one, the HTV, they all burn up. The only one that comes back, that has science equipment on it, they don't have any bad stuff, no germs or cooties on the Dragon. Dragon always comes back and lands in the ocean, Pacific Ocean. They pick it up, so I know that one's good. Although I wouldn't want to go in that one either when it comes back. So I've probably got all these experiments that are coming back from the space station that the scientists are trying to get their hands on. You know, I know Roy wouldn't mind fooling around with all the biological stuff that comes out of that thing, but I want to go near it with the 10-foot pole. Back to you, Dick.
You're saying those experiments contain what, biologicals and toxic substances, Paul?
That's what I think. I don't know. Maybe everything's perfect. I've never looked inside one before. You know, when they first get it back, you know. But, I mean, it would be a biologist or a doctor's dream to get a hold of this stuff, and a scientist. I mean, that's what they all love. You know, to me, I like the engineering of it, and leave the chemicals to everybody else. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. In the case of the spacesuit, the astronaut wears a very big absorbent diaper. How they have to clean him up afterwards, that doesn't sound pleasant. If you want to really think about unpleasantness, think about three guys in this small capsule cramped together side by side on the Apollo mission for 3 days on the way to the moon. Can you imagine what the waste elimination and weightlessness of space on that project is like? No privacy in that situation. Think about that one, Joe. I don't think you want to volunteer to be an Apollo astronaut. To be RYY, K2RIW.
No, of course not. Well, you'll make it to the 50th anniversary, I'm sure, won't you?
Which is July 9th. That's only 2 months away. Is that what you're saying? Yes, I think so.
Of course. You know, that's going to be a memorable day, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Where were you and what were you doing that day of that landing, Paul? I mean, Joe.
Let's see. I was in high school. Because I'm younger than you by a good number of years. I was in high school.
Yeah, I was, let me think now, 29 years old, having worked for 5 years for AIL. I was an AIL engineer. AIO gave us a day off on the day that they landed. And AIO was owned by Eaton, and Eaton had supplied some of the switches that were on that spacecraft. Paul, where were you during the, and what were you doing during the landing? I'm going to ask Roy this question also. So, Paul, where were you during the lunar landing? And what were you doing? WS2N, K2IW?
Now, when he answers that question, I have a question for you, Dick. Another good one.
Okay, just we're running out of time. I'll make it quick. High school. I was like Joe in high school, and everybody was watching their black and white TVs.
Yeah, I was watching it on black and white also. Roy, where were you during the lunar landing, 1969, in June or July? July, I guess it was. Over to you, Roy.
Well, junior high school was out. I was home watching my black and white TV as well. We didn't get color until, I think, the late 70s.
So you were watching it, and did the school take off a day or lots of talk among your fellow students? Go ahead.
Wasn't it in July?
You're right. So there was no school at that time. Joe's got another question before we run out of time. Go ahead, Joe.
Net tonight at 8:30.
Well... being that you are the type of scientist that you are, I don't know when they're going to put men on the moon. Hope you'll be alive when they do. But when they put the next group of men on the moon, will you be able to listen to them directly? Do you think about that one?
At this time, I don't think I'll be able to, Joe. I was in a different world in those days. I had just built that 12-foot dish. The dish had enough gain in S-band. I had access to spectrum analyzers, parametric amplifiers from AIO and whatever. So, no, this time I'll not be equipped to do that.
Everything's going to be digital, too, now.
What a good point. Okay, 73, you guys. This was technet number 1,742, I think. Maybe 41, in that order. Bye-bye, you all. See you next week. We'll get into the serious science next week. Keep your eyes up, you're clear about listening.
Very good.
Roy, you want to take it 73? Have a good night, and I'll turn it over to Roy.
Certainly. Thanks to Dick, thanks to Paul, thanks to everyone who participated. Once again, if you have any mailbag questions, you can send them to mailbag@ac2gs.com. And if you want to see that video that Paul was talking about and the other things that I was talking about, it's at roy.ac2gs.com. So have a great week, everyone, and hopefully we'll all be back to do it again next week, 73.
The time is 12:04 a.m., 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. Time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater.
KDG.
Net tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.
Out of sorts. I would never be up like that, but well, you sound wide awake. Somebody, but you're a little low.
Well, I'm here, Charlie. I'm back.
And with the H of mobile. Hey, Matt. I heard you mention it, but I didn't get to listen to the whole tech net, so I didn't hear your explanation. So I'd be interested. What's up? Sorry, Great South Bay. That's the other club. I do belong to Lorimar because I use the repeater, but they support it. I don't get the meetings. I have to get myself to a meeting. I think they're having a meeting this week, but I'm doing something else. But anyway, this guy, Bill, I forgot his call. I got it written down. Bill is very knowledgeable. He helps out. He works on the repeater site. This guy works for, like, T-Mobile. He's a tech or engineer working with the cell sites, and he takes care of all of this stuff. So I was telling him my problem. I put an email out to the club, and I was telling him my situation. And I have ferrites, you know, all over the car. You know, I had to have them clamped where the extra coaxes were. I had to clamp to that. So I came out to my car when we were leaving, and where the coax goes in, like the coax, just the closest to it where you plug in the handset, but from the inside of the car, we took two of those ferrite beads. He made seven turns, because it's that thin coax, and clamped it on. I got to my mom's house, and I went on a net. It was a very little RF. Everybody's from 80 meters of a tough band with mobiles. It was very slight noise, not like it was, just very slight. And I got on the net on Sunday morning for my car, and I went on 20 meters last night, and I worked the station in Spain. It was like a special event, so it's fixed.
Fantastic. I'm glad to hear it. You know, I was on 20 and 40 last night. I was trying to get into the Indy, there was an Indy special event, and, you know, it's just impossible. They pile up, everybody wants to get in on that for the race car cards.
Very heavily last night, so I got my car about 8, just after American Idol started, and I said, let me bring my phone with me, and it's a website I go to called DX Summit. DX Summit is a website.